The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. This broadcast of the City Club is made possible with help from the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, 670 KBOI, and Boise State Public Radio. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mind Development. Additional grant funding comes from the Idaho Humanities Council, a state-based partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The moderator for today's forum is Karen Sander.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's City Club of Boise program, On the Rocks, Bars, Restaurants, and Music Venues in the Time of COVID. I'm Karen Sander, board president, and today's moderator. I am going to introduce our panelists. They'll give you a broad overview, and then we'll get into the Q&A and hopefully get a great dialogue started here. So Eric Gilbert is a founding member of the Treeport Music Fest and owner of the Duck Club, a major music promoter here in Boise. He's also a member of Save Our Stages. Rocky Johnson, the doyen of downtown's music scene. She is also an owner of Pampanhana's Bar and Venue. She's a board member of the Downtown Boise Association and co-secretary of FARE, F-A-R-E. She'll tell us a little bit more about that here in a moment. And then Dave Crick is a managing partner of Bitter Creek Ale House, Red Feather Lounge, and Diablo & Sons Saloon. He is board president for City of Good. He's a board president for FARE, Idaho, and a community board member for the Boise Farmers Market. He's a busy guy. So with that, I'm going to have Eric just kick it off for us, tell us a little bit about your background and some of the initiatives that you're working on during this COVID time.
Thank you so much for having me, for one, and in this Zoom world that we're living in. As one of the founders of Treeport, I'm a festival director, and you know, with Duck Club, we promote shows year-round in multiple venues. As most of the audience, I would imagine, remembers, like Treeport had the unique opportunity to be on being on the front edge of this of this cresting wave of a pandemic back in March. You know, we made the decision to postpone the festival before city or state closures even happened. But by the time the festival would have happened, the state was under closure. So. You know, so we've been, you know, we naturally interface with a lot of our regional counterparts and a lot of national counterparts too. But as the pandemic settled in, there was a lot of movement within the independent venues scene around the country, the independent talent scene, and we've been active partners with those groups, in particular in the National Independent Venue Association, which is a group of independent venues from around the country, similar to the likes of our like Neurolux and our Knitting Factory and Visual Arts Collective out in Garden City and stuff. And so I think there's been so many unknowns with all this that's going on, and I think, you know, I think I just kind of want to come on the fact that this has been very much like a natural disaster for our industry. Like our industry has been, you know, we were definitely one of the first to close, and we're still closed. And, you know, in the state of Idaho, as of yesterday, I mean, we've been closed, like performance venues, indoor venues in particular have been closed. Most of the events have been closed, and rightfully so. The science says that should be the case. And as of yesterday, we're officially like gatherings over 50 are still, you know, back in the state of Idaho, shouldn't be happening. And, you know, regardless of how enforcement is going along those lines, that's the guidance, that's the state guidance. And so it's been 7 months, you know, so it's a whole sector. And I think one thing I'd like to impart is, you know, a lot of people think of the music industry as big stars and big, arena and amphitheater shows, but really it's a big broad network of small talent, which I think Treefort showcases. So for those of you that are familiar with Treefort, you get a sense of how much is out there, you know. And then, but it's a bunch of small businesses, both on the venue, the like brick and mortar side, but also on the talent agency side, talent representation, the talent itself, and then also on the production side, like the sound companies and even, you know. So I think for some context here in Boise, it's like when we pull off Treefort with as many venues and everything that we have, we already at a full functioning, you know, city before this had to bring in outside talent to help with sound and stage and stuff like that. They're just not, you know, already stretching the resources thin here. So I'm, you know, there's a lot of concern about all the infrastructure that goes into live events in general right now, being able to, I mean, I think for people, if they think of their own sectors, you know, we're 7 months into not opening, we're going into winter, likely another 6 months before any sort of semblance of opening. So I've been really thankful for the organization around the Save Our Stages Act, which is something that, you know, hopefully Congress will act on. And it, you know, I think one of our big pitches around that is the fact that, yeah, like I think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has said that 86% or so of businesses have reopened in some fashion, but there's still, you know, 10 to 14% of businesses that are still shut down. So some more industry specific relief is in order, especially that directed towards small businesses. And I'm excited to be a part of this panel with Rocky and Dave Crick, because, you know, we're all part of a downtown ecosystem that we're really passionate about. And it's a really big part of what makes Boise special is the small business community in downtown Boise, and not only the day economy, but what happens at night too. And it's a very vibrant nightlife that has been pretty much shuttered. So I'm excited for all the work around the different coalitions. There's a lot of work to be done. Everything is stalled right now, and going into winter, it's pretty concerning about who's going to be able to make it through. So thanks for having me.
Thank you, Eric, for that. Rocky, let's move to you and tell us about what is going on in the bar industry, and then also a little bit about FAIR.
Okay, I really want to thank City Club of Boise and Karen Saunders for the invite today. I'm a huge fan of City Club, so I feel kind of girlish to be here a little bit to some degree. I listen on NPR frequently, so thanks for the invite. We are a 42-year family-owned business in downtown Boise. A lot of people don't realize how integral we've been in the community for that long. Family-owned business, as I mentioned, my husband built the place and laid every brick. So all the beautiful arches and mortar work that you see throughout the building has been done by hand by our family. We have many employees who have worked with us for that long, or at least, you know, half that long. And when COVID hit, we were, as Eric mentioned, we closed before we were required to, because we care about our community, we care about our staff, and we certainly care about our patrons. We've been a part of the vibrancy and vitality of downtown Boise for those 42 years, and we've added to the livability of the city to a large degree. When we opened, the Egyptian Theater was closed. City Hall wasn't there. U.S. Bank wasn't there. Certainly Zions Bank. None of those buildings were there. So that's how long we've been a part of the landscape and the vibrancy of the nightlife in downtown Boise and obviously beyond. You know, the difficulties have been that our staff, basically, we were caretaking our staff. We did apply for PPP funds. Those ran out. Our employees' benefits ran out, and we treat our staff are family to us. And so we took care of them as benefits were running out. They were pleading for us to reopen because they didn't have any other options. Many of them, our staff are single moms or students, or as I mentioned, people who've been with us for a long time and it was their only source of income. And with unemployment being as high as it is, there were no jobs in our industry. And we really took a hit, not just locally, but obviously nationwide. As far as an industry, when it comes to bars, we kind of got blamed for a lot of what's happened. You know, if don't go out to large gatherings and certainly don't go out to bars. And I understand that to a large degree, but what we provide in the, as well as the hospitality industry as a whole, we provide that sense of place. We give people that place of community that where they can gather. And as COVID progressed, we realized that we could still provide that sense of place and that sense of community. And we can do it in a safe fashion, because there are a lot of our patrons still want to gather. Human beings want to gather, and they will do so. And they will find ways to be with each other. They need to have entertainment and distraction. And so they're going to gather in homes and backyards at house parties. And we feel like if we are able to provide a safe place and maintain protocols and promote people's behaviors so that they maintain a safe environment for themselves and for others, that's better than just going out willy-nilly and partying wherever they can find the places to gather. It's better to come together as a community and to promote those good behaviors. And that's another thing that happened when the pandemic hit, was we realized as a hospitality industry that there was no go-to organization in the state of Idaho that would facilitate our needs, that helped us have representation with leadership and helped us with resources and finding ways to assist our staff and other things. And so when Dave Crick called me and wanted to know if I wanted to be a part of Fair Idaho and explained to me that it's food, agriculture, restaurants, and drinking establishments all coming together. And at that point, when we knew that there were farmers who were having to dump their food and let it rot, we realized that, you know, let's find a way to facilitate the need in the community to get the food and beverage out to people who need it and not have it go to waste. Let's find a way to collectively come together, help our hospitality and agricultural industry to survive and make it through this, help us all to find the resources and work together. And we're still in the building phase, but I will tell you that Fair Idaho is doing a lot of great work. And if check out the website, you can find out more about our organization by going to fairidaho.org. And I'm excited to see that not just through this pandemic, but as we move forward into the future, to have a way for us to coalesce as an industry with entertainment, with food, with beverage, and add more to the vitality and vibrancy of our city as we've always done in the past. So again, thank you for having me, and appreciate being here.
Thank you so much, Rocky. So let's move over to Dave Craig. And Dave, please tell us about yourself, the business, and then also a little bit more about this thing that you're calling a box of good that I'm hoping people order today for lunch.
It was just great to hear, I think, Rocky's story and Eric's story. And I mean, I know both of these human beings really well, and I am just thrilled, I guess, to share this panel with them and tell these stories, because they're the stories of, I think, what makes Idaho unique. It's our independent businesses, our food and beverage, our hospitality businesses, our cultural scene. That's what we live for. This is the place that we are. And so a lot of the businesses that were hit the hardest were, I think, to me, some of the most important businesses in this state. So yeah, I have a few restaurants in downtown, been in the restaurant business for a few years. It's a terrible time to be in the restaurant business. this was, you know, we're all supposed to plan for every potential crisis, but Boise was a pretty safe place. We don't have tornadoes or hurricanes or, you know, tsunamis. Pandemics, I guess we hadn't really anticipated what that was going to do to us. We were ill prepared. And I think that's the biggest crime in all of this, is that I think we were ill prepared for what this thing was going to do to us and how it would impact us. You think we have, you know, plans for what happens if Canada invades, but we didn't have a plan for a pandemic. And I think that was the most stunning part of this in the beginning. And I think for many of us, the combination of, I think, being caught flat-footed, not knowing what we were supposed to do, and then also just the lack of network. You know, Boise has this abundance of, I think, in fact, if we have a superpower, it's this abundance of really good people who want to do good, who want to volunteer in their community, and businesses who want to do good. I mean, it's almost like competitive. How many businesses here want to give of themselves or be seen as, you know, contributors to the local nonprofit scene? Sometimes it's frustrating. There's so many, you know, good things happening and nobody can shine because everybody else is outgooding them. But we didn't have good networks to tie it all together. There was really virtually no network that brought these things together. So as we're caught flat-footed in the middle of this pandemic, people are trying to do good work, but it was confusing. And we didn't have a strategy for how we pulled that together. So I think, you know, for me, my focus was what was happening with restaurants, our own restaurant, our own staff, the stress that all of them were under, but also other restaurants, culinary workers in general, who culinary workers are, you know, for the most part, low income and have their share of mental health issues, and watching them all become unemployed was very concerning. Farmers and their inability to access markets, and how are we going to deal with that? And out of that were born really two groups that came out of the same place. One was City of Good, which took on a local feel and more action-oriented. And it was really about, you know, putting people back to work, putting culinary workers back to work in safe positions. And our lane was working with food insecurity, because we can feed people. And ultimately, it became Food Insecure Children, which is, I think, a really terrific mission, because it's really about kids who are curious about food, who have access issues to food, and them helping us as much as we're helping them. The other one was FAIR, and it was really more policy-oriented around the state. We just lacked a network across the state to be able to be part of the conversation. That group quickly partnered with Independent Restaurant Coalition, a national group, and several of us now are on the leadership team for that group, and that group has a singular focus to pass the Restaurants Act, and I can talk about that more as we get into it, but it's parallel to what's going on with Save Our Stages. It's focused around not just restaurants. It's I think, poorly named as the Restaurants Act, because while it directly benefits restaurants, it is about restaurant supply chains. It's about bars. It's about nightclubs. It's about any business that's in the food and beverage business that's been hit hard by this. And yeah, we got lots of things going on, but I'll stop there.
Thank you, Rocky, Eric, and Dave, for these great introductions. I think that's a great way to segue into, you know, what are city, state, federal governments doing? I know, Rocky, you talked a little bit about unemployment benefits that have stopped. You know, Eric, you talked a little bit about what's going on with Save Our Stages, and Dave, the policy around FAIR. So what is happening? How are staff doing? What options are there out there? And, you know, what do we know that's coming down from either federal, state, or city to help these industries out? So maybe I'll have Dave kick it off, because you've mentioned it, and then Eric and Rocky, if you can follow on from there.
I think our leaders are stuck in the mud at almost every level. And many of us who, you know, are on the outside looking in are stuck between being cheerleaders, a lot of rah, 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 thank you, great job, appreciate that, but we need more out of you, and just really wanting to replace them and get them out of the way. At a federal level, there's nothing more important than what's happening with the next stimulus. And nothing's going to happen before the next election. I think Nancy Pelosi and Steven Mnuchin keep talking. It's valuable, because I think they're working on the mechanics of whatever that stimulus bill is going to be. But nothing's going to happen until the next election. And the next election, which is in, what, now a week away, it's big. It's as big as any of us have ever seen in our lifetime. And I think the outcome of that has all sorts of variables. You know, we're hoping it's a clean outcome. And with that, lame ducks can be highly productive. Lame ducks historically have been highly productive. And so we're hopeful that everybody is in the spirit of finally getting back to work. And the Restaurants Act and Save Our Stages, these are make sense bills. You know, it's the stimulus has a lot of complicated politics with it, but there is pretty universal consensus around the need to help businesses that were the hardest hit by this. The tools for that are debated quite a bit, but the Restaurants Act itself has 48 Senate co-sponsors, so we're almost there. I mean, if we could get Mike Crapo and Jim Risch, we'd be over the 50, but Crapo won't co-sponsor anything, but I think he'd support it if we can get into a final bill. But we're at 48. That's pretty good. And in the House, we've got 213 co-sponsors. I think Save Our Stages is pretty close to that, and Eric can speak to that. He keeps a much closer eye on it than me. So many feel like another round of PPP is a good solution. Our two senators definitely feel like PPP is a good solution. PPP, you know, it is not what it's made of. I mean, PPP was a lifeline for many of us. For me personally, PPP was great. But PPP was very expensive. You're talking a $500 billion bill that at the end of the day, I think when history looks at it, is going to find it. Mostly, if we wanted to do a stimulus bill, it's a good stimulus bill because we spent a lot of money in the economy. But it didn't really help the people who needed it the most. Businesses that were closed, businesses that couldn't adapt to find ways to use that money. The people who were hurt the hardest in this whole thing were low-income workers and small businesses, especially in wealthier urban districts. People who are not hurt, white-collar workers, people who are higher income, you know, they recovered from this pretty quickly. And I think that that's what complicates this, because a lot of them, you know, it's like the stock market's great and real estate's booming. And so what's the problem? Well, we have a ton of small businesses who are closing and are going to close over this winter. And we have to do something about it because it's significant. The restaurant industry alone employs 11 million people. And when you add the supply chains to it, it's 16 million. And that's really, that's pretty conservative. So it's a big deal. PPP is too limited and does not address the places that are the hardest hit. The Restaurants Act is basically a recovery of lost revenue. So it targets places with significant lost revenue. So your scale of your lost revenue determines your grant. And it's a grant program so that you can use it in a highly flexible way. So anyway, I think, you know, on a national level, that is by far the most important thing. But on a state level, you know, I just think, I don't know. I want to praise Governor Little because I think in a lot of ways he's got a really tough job. But hard things are hard. And that's what you get into elected politics for. You're supposed to be able to do hard things. He's just not capable of making hard decisions. We've seen this continuously, even yesterday. It's like going to stage three, really, what's the difference? And frankly, there's very little guidance to go with it. So, you know, how are we going to get through this crisis? Where are the grant programs for small businesses? The state may give back a ton of money to the feds. Yet we have small businesses that are starving. We have people that are out of work with no unemployment benefits. And I just am appalled at the lack of creativity on a state level. And we can't get a meeting with the governor. We've been trying to get a meeting with the governor for quite some time. And for whatever reason, he says he wants to meet with small businesses. I mean, I want a 15-minute phone call and I can't get it. On a city level, I think the city's been, you know, really working hard. They're somewhat constrained. You know, the grant programs are definitely constrained by state politics. So we got this latest, you know, $10,000 grant, but you're not eligible if you got a PPP loan or if you got the other one. Actually, I think it's a $15,000 grant. We've got restaurants that need, you know, heaters and tents and things to be able to make their outdoor space work. And there's just absolutely no funding for it. I think getting outdoor dining working better, outdoor spaces working better is a high priority and taking too much time. So I'm going to cut myself off.
Thank you, Dave, for that. You know, I, something that resonated when you were talking, Eric, about, you know, all these, it's not just the musicians, it's the support, it's the sound folks, it's the talent. You know, I was watching, you know, some news about Amazon hiring, you know, up to 4,000 people here in our valley. How do you get that talent pool back? And, you know, this impacts not only your industry, Eric, but even Rocky and Dave. You know, once, you know, $15 an hour, you know, at a starting pay plus benefits. How do you get somebody back after all of this? And where does that talent go? So talk a little bit about the ripple effect of, you know, the impact that that this is having on them today, and then if you lose them.
Yeah. So yeah, brain drain has been a conversation in our industry for sure. And really quickly though, I do want to address, like, so Save Our Stage is a really good companion piece for the Restaurants Act. It just fills a couple of gaps with that, with part, and to Dave's point on, and this related to the, your question is, like, you know, especially the disqualifying factor of PPP at the state level and the fact they're sitting on CARES Act funding. PPP was based on 60 days of closures. And so you know, if you think of like how that sort of is based on the amount of money that's some of the hardest hit industries received, it's just a drop in the bucket compared to what they actually need to sustain themselves. And the more like the lost revenue model makes a lot more sense, especially for, you know, if you look at the live event world being shut down completely and going, you know, going to probably get close to a year and a half. I think, in for some context for everyone that's watching, when Treefort happens next September 2021, in whatever modified version it may have to be, depending on where things are at, it's going to be 2.5 years since the last festival. And so as far as keeping talent, you know, and you know, especially because like the music world is a lot of like gig workers and a lot of that sort of, that sort of makeup. So it's already a hard industry. It's people are in it because they love it. So that's what will probably bring them back, is because they love it. But at the same time, like, I think it's a big question in our industry in general, like how long are talented folks within our industry going to stay if this just kind of continues to prolong and there's no help to keep people. You know, I was actually, you know, some of the venue calls I'm on a national level, there was one venue, I forget where they were, but they were considering letting their staff move into their venue. There are a couple of people that are being hit so hard, like they're like, and they want to take care of their team, because a lot of these teams, I know, I can imagine, like both Rocky and Dave's, like their teams are like family. They've been with them for, you know, in some cases decades. And so you don't want to lose them because of the talent, but you also don't want to force them out on the streets to go start over with their career just because this is just getting shut down for extended periods of time. So I'm not sure how we piece it all back together, but I think Dave really summarized everything really well. And I do agree, like leadership does seem stuck in the mud, seem hesitant to go out on a limb to do more nuanced approach, but nuanced approach is what's needed. I'm hoping the election being resolved, however it may be resolved, will help like move the needle when it comes to like action, because it's definitely frustrating.
Thank you, Eric. You know, Rocky, one of the things that that I think is in the media a lot is, and I think it's missed, is just how much work is going on behind the scenes to take care of your people, to take care of your clients. You know, there's a lot of perception or concerns about how to keep people safe. Talk to us a little bit about what you're doing in your business, what you did when you, you know, really pushed through to get bars back open at level 3. And just talk a little bit about, you know, how do you keep people safe in that environment?
Well, it's been a difficult time, obviously, for all of us, but the bar industry in particular, as I mentioned earlier, really took a hit with our reputation. I feel like we need to step up as industry owners, and we need to show the public at large that we can be good stewards of the community, and we can provide safe places for our staff and our clientele, and that we can be as responsible as any business when it comes to implementing protocols and mandates. It's not been difficult. It's been, not been an easy thing. We're catching it really from both sides. It's too bad, really, that this whole thing has become so politicized. Especially in our industry, we are taking it from both sides of the aisle. We're taking it for being open at all. Why are you even open? You're being greedy. You're just after the money. And that is certainly not the case when you have a family-owned business like ours and you have staff who are really hurting, whose homes are in forbearance, who are looking at evictions, who are looking at not being able to put food over the on the table. And then we're taking it from the other side of the aisle that, why aren't you just open full bore? How many times a week did I answer, well, why isn't the band back on stage? Why isn't the Rocky Johnson Band playing? And I just look at people and try to explain, well, it would be irresponsible for us to have a packed dance floor and to have everyone acting as if a pandemic is not occurring. And so what we try to do is to implement those protocols within our establishment, keep our capacity low at 25%, so that we can cover those fixed costs that we have on a monthly basis. Because even as a 42-year business, there are still those costs that we have to pay out every month. And we, being closed for the better part of 6 months, we were still hemorrhaging money. In addition to our staff having run out of benefits and being in such a difficult position. And as Dave mentioned, the PPP money was not a functional situation for us because we were supposed to spend 75% of the PPP funds on payroll when we were closed. So how do we keep our staff employed when we don't have work for them? We cleaned, we remodeled a few things, and we did what we could. But when you have to spend 75% of the money within a 2 month time frame on payroll when you're not open, it puts us in a very difficult position. So I really ask our leaders, especially here in Idaho, in the city and in the state, to try and turn down the noise. Try and not listen to one side or the other. Try and have some empathy and compassion for those of us who are in the front lines of this pandemic, trying to survive and trying to make sure that we make it through safely and with the viability of our businesses in mind. And to, if you could just narrow your focus to where, as Eric mentioned earlier, there's those CARES Act funds that are sitting there with the state. Will that money just go back to the Fed? I mean, come on. Let's get those funds out to those of us in the front lines and help compensate for the loss of business that we've had over the last 7 months, going on 8 months now. And remember that we need to be here when it's when this thing is over. And we need to be a vital part of the community as we always have been for a long time.
Thank you, Rocky. So just a quick follow-up. Does the Restaurant Act provide money for bills other than payroll?
Yes. It does. Restaurant Act is a grant program, and yeah, you can basically use it for any business-related expenses.
Great. Thank you, Dave. Eric, go ahead.
I was just going to follow up on Rocky's point about the state, and it was also to a viewer question from Laura. There, it's not without precedent that other states in the union right now have done more with their CARES Act funding that came from the feds. And I think one of the best examples I keep using locally is Montana, because they received the same exact amount of money of CARES Act funding. They passed a couple months ago. They did $10 million for live event venues around the state based on revenue loss and based on revenue from the previous year. I think it's 25, they could get up to 25% of their 2019 revenue. So it's not like filling up everything they made, just kind of a baseline. And is it scaled? Like the Rebound Act capped it, I think $10,000 or $15,000. The fact that that's not scaled to a business of more size and more loss, and it should be better addressing the need. And we've been in touch with the folks in Oregon. The Oregon legislature did $50 million and also included some I know there's like half of that was for live event venues and not for profit orgs and stuff. And so those are some of the closest ones to us. But Wisconsin just did $15 million for venues. New Hampshire did $12 million for venues. So the state is sitting on the same amount of money, the same program. And so we're hoping because they have to expenditure it before the end of the year. So there is hope that they will do something in the near term, but we'll see.
Thank you, Eric. Dave, you know, we're getting a lot of questions about, you know, winter's coming up, weather's cooling down. You know, dining has been, you know, it pivoted to moving outdoors. And I think downtown Boise is an example of where sidewalks and, you know, even some of the parklets, the parking spaces were reused for outdoor dining. Tell us a little bit about how that happened. And how do you move forward? And how is the city of Boise helping out? You know, it's not easy to rent tents and heaters. I don't even think you can find a heater right now to rent or buy. So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing as a restaurant owner and how you've been working with the city on that initiative.
Yeah, so I think we realized right away that if we were going to reopen, the safest way to reopen was to get outdoor dining going. And, you know, too many people, that option was fairly limited. And so we needed tools to be able to expand that. You know, if I step back just a little bit, I think when you think about, this probably relates to all of us, but mostly in the restaurant industry, I kind of put people in three classes. And I think one of those classes is the people who are pushing the envelope. So these were the people who were open May 16th and ready to go, mostly suburban or rural, but also in the city, we had some of those people. You know, guidance to them was like, yeah, guidance. Sure, we're going to do what we need to do, but we're going to do what our guests will tolerate. And we're going to, and there's restaurants, you know, you get out into Eagle and Meridian, and there's restaurants doing better than they did last year. And that's, it's frustrating, but I guess good for them. I hope that, you know, from a public policy standpoint, it works out for all of us because our priority ought to be making sure people don't die. And I think second to that is making sure that we keep our kids in school as much as we can. And so our businesses are luxury businesses that if we shouldn't have them open, and, you know, in the case of large venues like Eric's dealing with and arenas, you know, it probably is best to keep them closed, but we've got to have economic tools to help them facilitate that, to navigate that. That's been completely lacking, which is just frankly stunning and criminal. But in our world, there's that class. There's that class that's doing very well. Across the state of Idaho, it's mostly rural. So a lot of restaurants are doing okay because they pretty much just operate wide open. You've got those that are closed or limited. And the closed and limited are for different reasons. Sometimes the venues are too small. The restaurants are too small. We have one, like Red Feather. There was no way we were going to reopen that because by the time we socially distanced it, there's not enough seats to make it work. So it's just overflow for the bakery. But you can look around town. I mean, our friends at Petite Four, I think there's a half dozen others. I'm failing to remember right now. But that they're just their venues are just too small, so they've adapted to takeout models. And they've maybe got some financial structure. I know a lot of people who just haven't been able to open it, had the financial structure to just be able to weather it. And, you know, for ethical reasons, they just said, you know what, we can do this without being open, rather not. But you've also got people that in other states, other restaurants that can't open because of, you know, the urban nature of where they exist and the complications of it. And that's one of our biggest concerns. And it should be a big concern for Idaho because, oh, by the way, those are a prime market for much of our agriculture industry here in the state. The last group, which is the group that I think we're really talking about, is those who are trying to thread the needle. It's the group that doesn't have the choice to be closed, but also isn't willing to just operate full throttle. They give a crap. They want to do this thing right. And how do we help that group? I think in this particular group, this is where our focus with outdoor dining, you know, played an important role. And it was important early on because it helped restart their businesses. That was where you kind of got going. But now as we look forward, you know, it's become a significant part of the business model. And I think as we look to winter, it's like, would people really be willing to eat outside during the winter or be outside during the winter? And I think the answer is yes. If they want to support restaurants and they want to stay safe, they're willing to do it. But we need tools. We've been slow to react. I think it's been, you know, both good in that I think local leaders have worked hard to make this happen, but bad because I think there's a lot of, you know, typical bureaucracy and red tape that has prevented these things from happening as fast as they could. So we've now got some expanded sidewalks and we've got some parklets. Now what we need is a longer window, and I know that our council is working on that. A window is important because it creates a runway for investment. So as a small business, if you want to be able to take advantage of your outdoor cafe, your expanded space, it might be nice to put some money in it, but you're not going to put money in it if it's only going to last till the end of the year. So if we could get those things for the next 2 years, which is what many of us have been arguing for, then all of a sudden it's like, okay, I can do this for 2 years. Well, now I can put some money in it. Now I can invest in some fencing, some other things. And if we know we've got 2 years, then can we get some grant funding, even if it's just matching funding, to be able to do design work? Parklets can be really cool. The ones we have in Boise are useful, but let's face it, they're not very cool. And they could be a lot more functional if we put a little bit of creative design to them, but that takes money. And then when you get to the point where you've actually got a design that you like, and I think this is an opportunity for Boise to rethink its public space and how we use it, it is going to take some tools to be able to get those things built, especially ones that are really attractive, that work to improve the public space and that are functional and useful for the establishment. So, anyway, I don't know if that's a good question or not.
I'd like to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Eric Gilbert, Rocky Johnson, and Dave Craig. So I'd like to pivot to a little bit of, you know, we just talked about outdoor dining, the parklets. What are some of the other innovations that you made in your businesses in the last 6 months that you would like to see continue indefinitely? You know, what are the things that are happening now that you go, why didn't we think of that before? And how can we move forward incorporating those into your business? So let's start with Rocky.
Well, one of the things we decided to do was go ahead and figure out a way to put some of the musicians who have worked with us at our venue for a long time back to work. And so we decided to safely space tables and chairs on the dance floor and allow for some quiet music early in the evening before, you know, things get too crazy. And not allow, obviously, for a packed dance floor, but at least to be able to put those musicians back to work. So I think going forward, it's been very well received, and the music has been terrific. And as Eric alluded to earlier, the brain drain for the musical industry has been terrific. A lot of musicians have had to find day gigs, and hopefully with the passion that they have and the love that they have for music, they'll be back as we get through this pandemic and see light at the end of the tunnel. But that's something we're going to probably keep in place. Go ahead and open up more as an entertainment venue. I've kind of hogged the stage as the Rocky Johnson Band for a few years now. And I'm glad that I've been able to do that. I feel that our space is beautiful and accommodating, and we have a great sound system and that type of thing. So we'll be moving forward with that. The other aspects of it, you know, I did want to touch on something that as far as we haven't really talked about the lack of enforcement when it comes to protocols within the state. And Dave had talked earlier about how he feels that Governor Little could have done more. I mean, we'd like to see a mask mandate. I know there are parts of the state that would really be resistant against that. And I understand that there are rural parts of the state that probably don't see the need for that at all. But here in Boise and in other parts of the state, you've got Twin Falls, where the hospitals are full. You've got the Veterans Hospital here in Boise that's full. We've got to really take a serious look at this thing and figure out ways to for our leadership to step up and do those things, those mandates that really need to be implemented in an enforcement fashion, so that we wind up talking the bad actors into coming back to the table and doing the things they need to do to make sure that they keep their patrons and their staff and all of those other people who might be affected, obviously, as they go home and to their other jobs and places, safe and well. And that's looking at the end of this thing. I think that's the only way we can do it, is figure out a way to implement some kind of oversight and enforcement.
Great. Okay, thank you, I'll hand it over. Eric, if you can talk about some of those initiatives and innovations that you think will come out of this that you would incorporate.
Yeah, I think within the, you know, music and event community in general, like I think there's some, you know, I think artists and some of their teams are building new tools with, you know, online streaming and things like that. But, and I think that's going to be a piece of their tool belt moving forward. But I think there's good consensus around the fact that as far as it's not going to replace the live event industry by any means, but there's some interesting supplements to it that I think everyone has gotten, as we all, probably everybody on this call has got a little better at our online streaming game with Zoom calls. You know, one of the just anecdotally, I like that now when I do phone calls with artist agents and stuff, a lot of times we get on a Zoom and I see their face more often. So I like that coming out of this. But, you know, otherwise, you know, I think more sanitization will probably happen amongst all of us, which I think that's an upside in the long term. Like my kids, you know, been doing in-person school and I haven't gotten sick yet this year. So, I mean, that's knock on wood, for obvious reasons, but, so I think that's going to be, but overall, like, I think that's like with the live events, it's more that, you know, we got to wait it out. Like there's not a lot of things we can change. Everything feels like band-aids. But with that said, like one of the things, at least locally, like Duck Club, we've loved our collaboration with Kin. They have that outdoor sort of amphitheater space that, you know, that's a collaboration that, you know, we had kind of been talking about, but we wouldn't have really developed it the way we have. We've been working with, you know, we've been helping with the music side of a lot of their like picnic shows. And if you haven't been to one, it's getting cold, but we're going to continue to try to do those best we can. And that's been just a fun collaboration where, like, you know, just collaborating outside the box more directly with the food scene has been fun for us. And as a way to like sort of mutually find our path through this, at the very least from a spiritual standpoint, and then stabilizing financially too. But I have to admit, no big revelations on the innovation side, on the live event side, personally.
Thank you, Eric. Anything to add to that, Dave?
Well, innovations? To me, I think the biggest thing that I've seen happen is our ability to work together. So I think, you know, like the work we're doing at FAIR is incredible. We've got over, you know, I think we're at 100 members, or getting close to 100 members now, and it's got the potential of growing, you know, 2, 3, 4 times that. And the engagement of that many people, just having that Rolodex, is so powerful. All these people that I didn't know before that now come together on a regular basis and talk. And now we've got this national network where we get together a couple times a week and talk with restaurateurs. Who's who in the industry, frankly. I mean, sitting in these conversations, and I'm like, I'm sitting here talking to, you know, Sam Cass or Calicchio. It's just crazy that we've got this national network now that we can plug into. We didn't have that before this. And so we're able to leverage their knowledge and their ideas into our local community. And I think what we've done with City of Good in bringing together, I think, businesses that want to do good in the community and trying to figure out how to work together to deploy something that is actually really useful and brings together a number of different sectors. So, you know, in that regard, we're working with restaurants to use local products from local farmers to build these fuel kits that help feed food insecure children, who are in turn helping us figure out how to improve our kids' menus inside restaurants, because let's face it, chefs aren't very good at feeding kids. Kids actually care about food, as it turns out, and they have a lot of opinions about it, and we tend to ignore them. And so it's been really fun to be engaged with these kids, especially a lot of these really vulnerable kids, and help them maybe find a path through their condition through the food industry. So building networks, I think, has been, you know, one of the things that is a good outcome of all of this.
Thank you, Dave. So a follow-up for here, you, Dave.
Here. I just want to say, that I think is one of the biggest outcomes too. And it's been fun, for example, us collaborating more within this group, but also on a national level too. I agree that we're all in this together mantra has actually been put into action. It's been great.
I love that. That's great. So Dave, a follow-up question that we've received from the audience about delivery and, you know, to go, and is that still helpful versus dining in? And also talk a little bit about, you know, some of the restaurants that do have a drive-through or can pivot to delivery or, you know, takeout versus those that cannot.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. There's a lot of places that were well positioned for it and were able to deploy that. And it's, I think we've seen a pretty rapid acceleration of takeout and home delivery of meals. I think, you know, this has been one of those things that's been on the periphery for a while, the idea of ghost kitchens or the use of some of these, you know, gig economy services and some of the challenges with them, how we work with them or don't work with them, build your own distribution system. And so what's been fun to watch is just how people have innovated. I've really liked, I think, you know, some of what Ken and T4 and David Rex at Wilder are doing. I think those are some of, to me, the more interesting models where they're packaging up dinners and theming them and you go get them. And they're just wonderful. And it's a way to kind of access their special creative talents, but doing it in a safe environment at home. So I think that's been really good. And I think, you know, for a lot of them, it's been significant income. They've done well with that. That's been, you know, an important part of what they're doing. So I think this winter, that becomes even more important. And we need more structural support for that. I think, you know, as we look at downtown, it's like we've got to institutionalize how that process happens. Unfortunately, some of those gig economy cars hog up all the key spaces. So some of the smaller, you know, more vulnerable places struggle to overcome the bigger places that are using those. And so I think we just need tools that allow for a little more fairness in terms of how pickup and delivery happens. But outside of that, it's been a positive part.
So we've got about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to have each of our panelists just tell us in their own words, why does this matter? Why should we care about these industries? If they go away, you know, what does it matter? Tell us why we should care. So I'm going to kick off with Rocky first. Why should we care?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, and I, you know, obviously I'm proud of the work that we've done, not just as a business, but as members of the community. I have chaired and co-chaired many a charitable cause over the years. We've hosted events both at Hannah's and at other venues that we're very proud to be a vital part of the community as far as raising awareness for certain issues, as well as funding and that type of thing. Also, I really want to emphasize how important it is that every community have a sense of place. It gives people a place to gather, a place to camaraderie, and where to interact with each other. Human beings will gather, and we've got to find ways to facilitate that in a safe way throughout this pandemic. But at the end of it, it really is so important that we are still a part of the landscape, that we're still a part of the vibrancy, vitality, and livability of our communities. And without us there, I mean, it could be like it was before Hannah's was there, with tumbleweeds going through the streets of the city. We really need those entertainment venues to make it through, not just because of the side industries and those who are involved integrally in the entertainment aspect, but also restaurants, bars. We need to find ways to facilitate the farm to table and keep those mechanisms in place to make sure that we are still a vital part of the community at the end of this thing and maintain who we've been for decades and keep that sense of place.
Thank you, Rocky. Eric, let's go to you.
Yeah, I think the sense of place is a really big part of it. You know, Boise has such a vibrant downtown, and that's such a big part of why a lot of us love living here. And that feeds into a lot of other industries too. But I will say, like, you know, the few events, you know, there's a lot of us have been, you know, we were all doing modified gathering right now. And the upside of that is you see the benefit of that like casual gathering. Like there's no better way to sort of reduce tensions amongst a community than to have gatherings where people can bump into their neighbors and just have casual opportunity to touch base and to, you know, be connected. And that, you know, and that's kind of why culture matters. But, you know, the thing is our cultural scene is also a huge economic driver. Like, I don't think people really think of it like that. And it has such a huge economic impact, both directly, but indirectly, both in like how when people go to a live event, they're also going to go eat at the restaurant next door, but also to the white collar scene. Like a lot of people, sure, they can work from home, but they still want to, at the end of the day, live in a town where they can go and see LED at the Morrison Center, or go to Shakespeare, or go see a rock and roll band at the Neurolux. So, or I go see Rocky Johnson still playing at Hannah's, you know? And so all that stuff, I think there's a lot of indirect and direct value to all the things we're talking about. And thanks for having me.
Thanks, Eric. So bring us home, Dave. Why does this matter? You've got 2 minutes.
Why does this matter? I forgot what you had asked. I don't remember. You know, in Idaho, it matters because we've got over 80,000 people that work in our restaurant industry. It's a significant part of our population, a big part of our ag economy in this state. Dairy, beef. I mean, half of the beef that gets sent out of the state ends up on our restaurant plate. So it, you know, it matters to this state how we treat our small businesses. Beyond that, it matters because, you know, every time we have something happen in the economy, every time we have a recession, we have no problem bailing out Wall Street, bailing out the banks, bailing out the airlines, bailing out the automotive industry. But our small businesses, our independent businesses that you know, operate on Main Street, they don't have the financial resources to access capital when we have challenges like this. When you get above 20 units, you're now too big to fail. There are people invested in your business that aren't going to let it fail because they've got the means to make sure that it doesn't fail. But when you get down to a small business operator who's got one or a few units, they're in it on their own. They're in it, you know, with their own skin. And when things go this bad, they have no way to access capital. So we need to invest in our small businesses. This is our community capital that is critical to who we are and how we think of ourselves. And frankly, it's just fair. We deserve it. And it's a good return on investment. The economic impact from investing in our venues and our restaurants and our bars and making sure that they get through this safe. First of all, we all win when we all win. So let's win. Investing in them returns a significant economic impact to our state that far exceeds whatever we're going to put into it. So,
Dave, thank you. And you've been listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation. I hope everybody can join me in thanking Eric Gilbert, Rocky Johnson, and Dave Craig for participating in today's discussion. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a forum about bars, restaurants, and music venues in the time of COVID-19. You can register for City Club forums and learn about becoming a member at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-364-4614. You can connect on social media by searching for City Club of Boise.